The Other Side of the News is a current and dynamic companion to augment the discussions from The Other Side of Midnight.
We investigate, explore, and extrapolate facts to gain better understanding of current affairs and events, and thus
to bring comfort and calm to our wide international audience. It's a spontaneous commentary
based on well-verified references vetted through vigilance and discernment.
Our desire
is to awaken your imagination
with questions.
Questions that have not been asked, yet need answering. The Other Side of the News is a place where you can come and be with us in community.
Learning new things, asking questions, getting compelling answers,
and interesting viewpoints. It's about curiosity.
We present thought-provoking questions to incite your mind, propelling you to see the world in another way. With clear insights and fresh perspectives on global events.
Tune in for a balanced view
of The Other Side of the News.
Welcome. My name is Timothy Saunders. I'm one of your trio of co-hosts in the 77th edition of The Other Side of the News. I'm speaking to you this early morning from Southwest Turkey. As the sun rises here, whichever time zone you are currently experiencing, hopefully you're relaxing into the show and are eager to hear some fascinating insights from our latest guest. I will soon be joined by Kintia from her infamous wheelhouse near San Francisco and Anessa Driscoll, who is currently making her way across the Mojave Desert. This show is entitled Exhuming the Truth. We're going to address an incredibly special and yet common event that occurs to all humanity, which is surprisingly seldom ever talked about in everyday life by many of the inhabitants of our planet's diverse and rich cultures. As a result, few know many of the precise details about it, either from being shielded by others or simply from those individuals who choose to generate a fear bubble rather than address this great unknown. That is, until the time inevitably comes when they may be compelled to deal with it head on. Some cultures journey through life totally at peace with the fact our physical bodies eventually reach a point where they simply no longer function efficiently. However, for many, the mere thought of death leaves them cold totally. Or worse, brings on a sense of delusional abandonment to this important subject. The ancient Egyptians had no word for death. Instead, those who passed away were said to go west, like the setting sun. They also believed it was necessary to have their hearts weighed on a scale against the mass of a feather. Most of our predecessors were often buried with ritual and respect, often marked by special stones and/or symbols. The Vikings used to burn their dead in ships. Some cultures rush to bury their dead the same day as their passing. For others, this is less important than displaying the body to the entire family in an open casket. Even today, the UK royals are said to be buried in lead-lined coffins. While the dead during previous plagues are reported to have been buried in mass graves, we now see PPL more important than protocol. Death should surely serve as a positive reminder we should make the most of our life today and make every subsequent day count. Truth and knowledge illuminates what is shrouded in darkness. While physical death will come to us all, it is not only a concept we should get used to, it is one we should embrace. That is until we learn how to extend our lifespan, perhaps by optimizing harmful subconscious programming, and to learn how to remove and then avoid toxins from entering our sphere in the future. There is every possibility that we are far more than the sum of ourselves, and our consciousness lives on, certainly through DNA transmission, and most likely in other higher forms. Death is also at the heart of the unparalleled fear porn still being generated hand over fist by the minority, distributed by our weak-minded puppet governments, and amplified through mainstream and social media propaganda. So stay with us as we dig a little deeper while we gently navigate this sensitive subject with a view to learn more about just how our loved ones are treated between the instant their heart beats for the last time and the moment they are either engulfed in flames during cremation, put to rest or lowered to a depth of 6 feet under in a coffin. Along the way, we will also discover the inside story from a very unique perspective, from one of the specialist individuals who carry out this delicate work each day with his team. And considering the population of the Northern Hemisphere is now entering its second winter during 2 weeks to flatten the curve of this insane faux pandemic, we will also learn some invaluable insights into the actual death numbers in relation to the COVID timeline, before, during the first wave, and after the rollout of the experimental injections. Keith, please play Sound Excerpt A.
The FDA had a meeting yesterday. One of their advisory boards had a meeting yesterday. That advisory board is called Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. And they had a meeting about the Pfizer vaccine and other vaccines yesterday. And at the 4-hour and 20-minute mark, this little bomb was dropped. Let me read it so I have it verbatim. In the FDA virtual meeting yesterday, the FDA advisory committee stated, "We were falsely misled by Pfizer about the safety of the vaccine. Heart attacks are 71 times higher than any other vaccine. The vaccines are killing 2 people for every 1 life saved." Wait, you mean it's not FDA approved? You mean it's killing more people than it's helping? You mean this dangerous experimental vaccine that we have been telling you for months is a bad fucking idea? Is actually a bad fucking idea per the FDA? Huh. No shit.
This is an excerpt from a recent podcast by Max Egan, who is now emigrated from down under to Mexico. More about that in future shows. Before we bring on our guests, I'd like to say a few words about a man who, unfortunately, I did not have the pleasure to meet. However, I am reliably informed he is a man worthy of special note and is someone who clearly lives on through his daughter. Thomas David Driscoll was born on August 18, 1928 in Columbus, Ohio. Tom was an entrepreneur and a gifted inventor who influenced many fields, including aviation, medicine, lighting, and implant dentistry. He led the design and development of the FAA standard VASI system, that visual approach slope indicator, which millions of air crews and passengers have benefited from, and to this day remains in use at many airports around the globe. He developed ultra-high-powered lamps that have illuminated the Empire State Building, the Guggenheim Museum, and even the Panama Canal. He also designed the first heart-lung machine, which was used to treat over 600 patients in central Ohio. Tom also designed the first freestanding dental implants, also known as Bicon implants, as well as devising a synthetic bone grafting material named Synthograft. Further, he published a paper on zirconia, which has become a widely used dental material. Tom went on to receive 2 coveted IR100 awards, likened to the Nobel Prize for Technology, one for Synthograft in 1982, and the other for the development of an infant respirator in 1973. Tom was an avid sportsman, a supportive mentor, a beloved friend, and a loving husband, father, and grandfather. Tom passed away earlier this year at the age of 92. He is sadly missed, but remains greatly appreciated. Let's take a moment to appreciate Tom's achievements. I believe he'll be remembered as a pillar of humanity.
Let's just take a deep breath together and acknowledge Thomas Driscoll. He touched many lives. Many who will never even know his name, and yet he had an impact on their life. From life-saving technologies to enhancing life technologies, Thomas was an unusual man. I had the pleasure of meeting him when he came to visit Aneta. I actually have had the opportunity to meet quite a few geniuses, but Thomas Driscoll, Tom, he stood out because he was very different than any of them. He was a gentle man, very gentle. The expressions on his face were gentle. There was nothing arrogant about him. In fact, if you didn't know he had all these accomplishments, he certainly wasn't tooting his horn at all. He was very welcoming and kind, very friendly, genuine, and a soft, gentle expression on his face. I enjoyed being around him. I was also struck by how limber he was. I mean, when I met him, he must have been at least in his 70s, maybe going into his 80s, but he walked like a young person. He was not stiff. He was fluid. And I thought that reflected his fluid mind. It was a quick mind. And I'm really grateful I had that opportunity to meet Tom. You never know when you're going to meet a star. And I would say that's true for all of us. You know, you never know how many lives you're going to touch. So when I think about loved ones who've passed on, it is always for me a call to revisit what do I want to contribute in this life and how do I want to be remembered. Thomas was that kind of person. He contributed to many people's lives, and it was just the natural expression of who he was. So I'm grateful for that opportunity. Annetta, I want to thank you for introducing me to Tom. You want to tell us a little bit about your dad?
Yes. Well, actually, I believe he was 84 when you met him.
Oh, my gosh. He had such a youthful countenance.
He did. And I'm lucky there because that runs in the family. So he died 1 month short of his 93rd birthday. And interestingly enough, like Cynthia was saying, he was actually quite healthy physically. Unfortunately, he was suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia. We're not quite sure which. The most unfortunate thing about this for me, and I think for everyone, is that he was placed against my will in a nursing home facility on March 13th, the day that California went to lockdown, March 13th of 2020. And although I traveled to, he was in Ohio and I live in California, I traveled to Ohio several times to try to visit him, and I never was allowed to see my father again because of the pandemic restrictions. And on top of that, there are a number of things. My stepmother, who had medical power of attorney, decided to give him the jab, and ultimately this killed him. He died of a massive, massive blood clot in his brain. And I actually had an experience of having him visit me in my dreams that night that he was dying. And he showed me a very an explicit autopsy of a brain and what was in it. And this was, it might sound a little strange to people, but I grew up with my father. He was a biomedical scientist and he did biomedical engineering. I was always around him when I was a little kid. I would see autopsies and surgeries, so this would not be all that unusual. And then I also had an experience the next day. A video showed up that I've never seen before, never seen since, and I will have that included on the page about what I saw. If you're interested, I'll put it in my items. So I wanted to let people know that because we hear about these people. Maybe you know someone, maybe you don't. But for me, when I talk about the dangers of the vaccines and what they really do, and we have all our guests on, this is very personal for me. It's not the only thing that I've experienced in my family. Most listeners know that I have a growing list of family members that have been affected very negatively by the lethal injection. And so I wanted to make that clear. And I also want to talk a little bit about, since we're talking about my dad, some of the things I refer to them in various shows. You know, it's pretty frequent that I do so. My father was a really unique guy. He was really quite brilliant, and I was very, very lucky to have him as a father. He really believed that everyone should be very well-rounded, have lots of interests, and education should be well-rounded. And he also had a unique way of teaching things. He was very hands-on, and he didn't want me to smoke. And so he was always bringing things home. And one day, I was young. I was probably about 8, 9 years old. One day he brings home 2 half-gallon jars, glass jars, and he plops these things in front of me on the table in the kitchen. And he says, "So what do you see?" So I'm looking at it. And, you know, I'm clearly looking at a body part in formaldehyde. And I'm taking a guess, but it looks like lungs to me. And he's like, "Yeah, right, it's lungs." And so what do you see? What's the difference? And he, you know, one of them looks, you know, pink and pretty healthy and stuff. And one of them looks black and tarry and really nasty, really nasty. And he says, "Well, you know, what do you see the difference?" And so I told him. And he said, "Well, you know, we were cutting it short here, but, you know, we talked about a little bit about where these lungs came from. And the individuals they came from were both male. They were both 45 years old, both basically all identical except for one of them was a smoker." And that's how my dad taught me to never smoke. You know, it was always a story. It was always an experience. It was very experiential. So, you know, he didn't want me to do drugs. So he took me down to Skid Row on a Saturday morning. And we had he always liked to drive roadsters. I came home from the hospital in the TR3. And I think at the time we had an Austin Healey Sprite and a Bug Eye Sprite. And they run really low to the ground. They're like, you're sitting on the ground and the curb is right there. And the top was down. He pulls up and it was, I don't mean to be totally gross, but there was, you know, the odors were pretty significant and the visual of these people that had had a very, very rough night and were literally in the gutters. And he said, you know, if you do drugs, this is what happens. This is how you end up. And needless to say, I don't do drugs. I never have. So, you know, he had these great ways of teaching, and I talk about Tomisms, and I'm so grateful he was my father and that I got to have that experience. And I am sorry that he went the way he did with the vaccine, because I know that he would have never made that choice. He knew better. And he was always telling me about the FDA and about the government. So what's really disturbing and sad for me is that my father would never have agreed to taking the jab. He understood the government and especially the FDA and the NIH. He battled these organizations his whole life, and he was always telling me about the corruption and also, you know, how things worked in the medical industry, how things were marketed, where the funding came from, and why certain things that were inferior went ahead. So actually, I'm kind of well-suited for what we're talking about now in our world, because I grew up with a father who was always pointing these things out. And it wasn't a conspiracy theory fact. It was an analysis, because he was experiencing these things firsthand and running things through the patent office and dealing with the FDA approvals, and went through it my entire life. I watched him, like many people that are ahead of their time, they get laughed out of the auditorium only to turn around 35 years later and be awarded these incredible awards. That was about Synthograph, in fact. I remember him being laughed out and the humiliation, and I remember him winning the top invention award for the same product 35 years later. So these kind of things happen. But I don't want to talk too much more except to say that I would encourage anybody, if they hadn't had a father like mine, to, you know, go ahead and learn all the different things you can and let your horizons be far-reaching. My father was a expert cook, and he taught me the love of food. He taught me the love of music, particularly classical music. we would dance in the living room at holidays and, you know, go stream stomping. And I, you know, I know how to identify every tree and salamander. And he taught me the Latin names and the, you know, the common names. And, you know, he taught me how to drive a manual transmission, because he said if you're ever going to drive a car, you need to know. So my father also taught me a lot of other skills. He was into gardening, which isn't, you know, terribly unusual. But he was a great landscape designer. He taught me how to work on my car, and I still do. He taught me how to build lots of things. But one of my favorite things he taught me was he actually, as a father, taught me how to sew. So he had no boundaries with what was male or female, and I love that. I'm grateful that I had that experience. My father was truly a Renaissance man. And, you know, all these different things, I could go on and on all night, but really try to grab life by the horns, and hopefully you get to live till 93 and have people that loved you. So that's what I like to say about my dad.
Well, he sounds an incredible character. And thank you for sharing that with us, Anessa. These are difficult times. And, you know, we know that while this was going on a few months ago, these are also difficult times during his passing. So, Kintia, would you like to take us on to the next point?
Well, I was just thinking this is the perfect time for a break. You're listening to The Other Side of the News, and our guest tonight is John Olooney, and the show is called Exhuming the Truth. We'll be right back.
As you continue to work on yourself, the tribe comes forward. They'll come right to your door. So just keep doing the work and it'll come together. Yep, as you increase your frequency, then you become more mature in your manifestation abilities, and your other higher senses and gifts come online, and then you have more power to make your world different and better and how you want it. And so that's why working on yourself is so important, because then you're going to create the reality that you want rather than get sucked into the dystopia that's being created by the negative or shadow side. We're becoming Renaissance men and women, where we have multiple skill sets and we can dance from science into art, and we can use both sides of our hemispheres, and we can realize how much we have to really offer and grow into. And this is what's happening now. This is where we're headed, into a really beautiful place. So we can rejoice in that despite the fear, despite what it looks like on the outside. This is how disease transforms. The mess in the chaos is necessary in order to see what you have before you, so you can clean it up and just make decisions to change your reality. If you don't see it, how do you know it's there to even be changed? Or if you ignore it, right? Then how can you make the differences? You can't. So the mess is before us. Accept our mess. And now know that that's part of empowerment, to be able to see and to be able to transform it. Hi, this is Amanda Vollmer, and I was on The Other Side of the News, and I really enjoyed my time discussing deeper topics and really getting to the heart of truth and the things that matter in this world, and what we are doing and why we're here and what we're heading towards. I really recommend listening in and learning, expanding your awareness and your knowledge. It's important, and these are the times to do it. And we're being asked to pay attention and to challenge ourselves and think beyond the box.
Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
I very much look forward to hearing our guest's perspective regarding this essential awakening process, all with a view to illuminate the best path to lead us to a positive outcome. You may find us at www.theothersideofthenews.com. There you will see details for the show, quick links to our bios, as well as links to our show items, references, and selected research. As usual, there's a huge collection of information to read, watch, and listen to, most of which has been handpicked from independent sources. I urge you to study them and even download your own copies sooner than later, as censorship robots are working around the clock to rewrite our history in real time. During the last week, we have been inundated by a deluge of remarkable events and headlines reported in the news. Discuss, validate, and present each topic in correct context could all too easily fill up an entire show by itself. As The Other Side of the News is not per se a typical news show, in order to make the best use of our available airtime, I believe we should plot a direct course to greet the rest of our team and introduce our special guest, John O'Looney.
Good evening and welcome back to The Other Side of the News. Tonight, our show is Exhuming the Truth, and our special guest is John O'Looney. And some of you may have heard him. He was kind of debuted on The Crow House with Max Egan. And he is a undertaker in the UK. And so he has firsthand knowledge about what is actually going on with the deaths and the reported deaths. So with that, I'd like to bring John in. Welcome, John.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
That's great to have you. So what I wanted to talk about, I'm kind of a statistical person, and I like a lot of facts and figures. And I'd like to have your just kind of your outline on what you think is going on or what you noticed with the numbers and what you observed.
So personally, the first alarm bells for me were the death rate being extremely low and nothing like, you know, what was being portrayed on the news. Throughout 2020, in fact, the death rate in 2020 was well documented as being no higher than any other year, you know. The vast majority of funerals that we do in the UK are cremations. The cremation figures support that. You know, there was no pandemic death rate. Around early 2020, I was contacted by a guy who identified himself as a pandemic a guy. He was sponsored by the government for a company. And he told me that he would be calling me every Monday to collate the numbers. He would ask me what my capacity was, how many I'd collected, who they were and where they were from, and how many were COVID. And almost instantly, the guy started steering me. And by that, I mean, everyone was literally labeled a COVID death, you know, whether it was cancer or dementia and Alzheimer's and old age, you know, everyone he insisted were COVID. And I kind of, that just didn't feel right. And I, you know, kind of said to him, you know, I spoke to the family. This was a well-documented cancer case. The guy's suffered with terminal cancer for the last 18 months. Oh, no, we know there was COVID in the care home. We know there was COVID in the hospice, we've been told, and rinse and repeat. And this happened really throughout 2020. Even one guy that was run over was a COVID case. You know, the guy had tire marks from his shoulder to his hip all over his abdomen, but he was a COVID case. Ridiculous. Totally, you know, there was no truth there at all, and it was deliberate. So there was that, and then also in early 2020, when other funeral directors were taking coffins to the hospital and sealing people straight in them, I was asked by a family who lost a young girl to cancer, who was six. They asked me to wash and dress her, and they wanted to spend time with their little girl, you know, and I couldn't bring myself to say no. Nobody else was washing and dressing. So I kind of washed and dressed this little girl for this family, and then thought, well, do you know, if I can do that for them, I can do it for everyone. And that's what I've done all the way through COVID, whether these patients are labelled with COVID or not, you know, because I just felt it was unforgivable what the hospitals were doing, you know. There was no need for it, no reason, and they streamlined the process. No doctors were in attendance, no police were in attendance. There was no COVID tests of any description, even the flawed PCR tests. So they were just labelling these people as COVID and letting them die, you know, often with midazolam and other sedatives, you know, needlessly. It was needless. And I've spoken to many nurses and doctors who have reached out to me to say that this took place in care homes where people were transferred into care homes and basically euthanized, you know, under the guise of it being a good death. And it certainly isn't a good death. It's murder. These are people that would have recovered if they'd been given a course of antibiotics, and the nursing staff have testified this to me on more than one occasion, number of occasions. They wouldn't let family in there because the families would have been witness, and that was done again under the guise of it being incredibly contagious and really, you know, a terrible pandemic. And it was just the whole thing was total lies, total truth. There was a virus, and as there is every year. And I suspect it was probably winter flu or perhaps a man-made virus, you know, that was being administered to people, perhaps even in the hospital environment, chillingly. A pattern I noticed emerging in people was they were saying that people were going in to hospital with other ailments, and all were catching COVID in there, you know, in the hospital environment. There were very, very few that were admitted to hospital with COVID. It was all done mostly they caught it in the hospital environment. And then in March, they kind of said the care homes were going to be hit with COVID. And lo and behold, as if by magic, the virus seemed to target specific buildings, which I found unbelievable and still to this day, unbelievable. And this was when the government's purchased up to 1,000% more sedative, and all of it was used. And the end result was a massive death rate for a very brief period of 2 to 3 weeks in care homes. And again, I've had nurses and doctors that have reached out and have confirmed what was going on. You know, the nurses were instructed to give 16 milligram doses, and that's a fatal dose. And again, the guys was, oh, to give them a good ending, you know, a merciful death. That's murder. But they know the law is clear in every country. And yeah, it took place. And now we have governments that legislate over us and tailor it for their own needs, but don't actually follow the law themselves. And nothing's being said, nothing's being done. And now they plough into schools and coerce children not old enough to vote or drink a beer or drive a car or get a job or have sex legally. But they can be coerced behind their parents' backs to take a life or death decision over an experimental gene therapy. You couldn't make it up. It's like a terrible horror story. And this is life in 2021. So 2020, it kind of went without any pandemic, despite their best efforts that were made. And there's a number of fronts this death rate, as they've made effort on. So one is medical neglect. People are not being seen by their GPs. They're not being referred to hospitals in a timely fashion. They're not seeing people for scans. And I've had families that come to me very upset because their loved one has been prescribed or given Gaviscon for 18 months when they've actually had pancreatic cancer or something like that. But they've, you know, no attempts have been made to actually treat them. So there's medical neglect there. In more than one family has come to me frothing with rage and grief and disgust at the way these governments have treated the people. And it got to the stage where November, December, we were doing funerals, but it was no busier than normal. And the figures collate, you know, they say that despite the best efforts they made in care homes, they still weren't really any increase on 2019. In fact, 2019 was busier cremation-wise locally. And I kind of suspected what was going on, and I predicted that once they began vaccinating, which was in January the 6th in 2021 in my area, that deaths would occur. And lo and behold, as if by magic, the death rate went through the roof instantly, around 300%, I guess, and it was horrific. And that lasted about 12 weeks until it petered off. And that was what they called the second wave. It wasn't a second wave. It was death by injection. I'm pretty confident in that. And a number of doctors and scientists and police officers and military people and care home staff, and they're all saying the same thing, and nobody's listening, you know. Very interestingly, I was asked to go to London on the 21st of September to have a meeting with Sir Graham Brady, who's the chairman of the 1922 committee. He's a very senior Tory MP, and I was surrounded by around 16 or 18 of the best scientific and legal minds globally. You know, the likes of Dolores Cahill, Tess Laurie, Sukrit Bhakti, and a number of other really eminent people, you know, none of whom I was really aware of, but who are all very aware of what is going on. And we all gave testimony individually to Sir Graham, and he didn't really seem surprised at all. You know, in fact, I would suggest he knew full well what was going on. And he left saying he couldn't make any promises and that he would do what he could, and nothing's changed, sadly. So he was told that children will die as a result of these injections. And already we've seen this in this country. There was a girl down in Essex, 12 years old, who died. There are others. They're not being linked. It's usually blood clots, the early deaths. And then later on, it will be organ failure or a heart attack or stroke, again, due to blood clots. It's happening all over the place. I'm getting people reach out to me. They've lost both their parents, literally days after a jab. But the way they're angling it is that, you know, you're not considered vaccinated until 14 days after, which by that which time, you know, you're dead before 14 days. So they're not tying these deaths in. I kind of like to think the best in people. I suspect most politicians, because it's a global movement, most politicians are complicit. That obviously is really concerning and harrowing that they could, you know, these men of supposed integrity and honour could do this to their own people. It's probably the most heinous crime that you could ever commit. And now we're seeing children directly targeted in schools. They were told what would happen with children, and lo and behold, children are dying. So that's kind of where we are, unfortunately. I kind of left the meeting. I went to the meeting full of hope that Sir Graham would actually make a difference and do something. But he hasn't done anything. Nothing's happened. And, you know, children are dying now alongside the regular people that coerced and blackmailed and bullied into taking these injections. I call them injections because they're not vaccinations. You know, and I believe that we're seeing a depopulation event. They're becoming very complacent about it now. If you were to type blackmail into Google, it's a crime. And yet here we have a government coercing employers to blackmail their employees into having a jab with the threat of the loss of their job. You know, these people are criminals. They're criminals. They're inciting crime. You know, I think I kind of left the meeting. I went to the meeting full of hope that something was actually going to be done and that there was decent, honourable, good, honest men in government, in the British government. And I kind of learned there isn't any. They all know. They know what's going on. And the feeling was one of despair when this guy left, because it was pretty obvious to everyone. And I feel now that only people will save people, and only numbers of people will save people. And unless people wake up and realise what's happened, very soon you're going to see a vast number of injection recipients get sick, and they will die, and they'll call it a new variant, and they're going to bring down draconian laws and probably violate every human rights law and the Nuremberg Code and begin forced vaccination. And then the real terror begins, doesn't it, you know, for everyone. So that's kind of where we are. I wish it weren't true, but I can't deny what I've seen as an undertaker. And from, you know, what kind of information and evidence has been given to me from the very, very expert people that I've met. Now, interestingly, The Guardian, I think The Times, reported the meeting with Sir Graham on the 21st and said we were a group of anti-vaxxers. Now, let me be very clear here. Dolores Cahill is the most wonderful lady who built her career on vaccinations. You know, she's run and been in charge of level 3 bio labs. She's advised government. She was advising government in her 20s. And I guess She's probably in her late 50s now, perhaps a little bit older. So she is at the very, very top of her game, as are all the other people. They've built their careers working around vaccines. These are not anti-vaxxers. These are anything but. And they are experts in their field. They see a terrible wrong. I see a terrible wrong on the coalface, dealing with the funerals. And the last couple of weeks, I've dealt with people in their 20s, in their 30s, all JAB recipients who have died suddenly from unexpected heart conditions. They've come into me. They've been cut from ankle to hip, where the coroners have been looking for the blood clots. The blood clots are reported, but not the cause of the blood clots, because they're not considered vaccinated. Do you know? You couldn't make it up. It's like a terrible, terrible horror film that I can't wake up from. And nobody seems concerned. Clearly, this is depopulation. You know, now, Sir Graham was warned by the people present at the meeting that there was a growing unrest. And when people realized what this government were doing to them, they would kick off and there'd be extreme civil unrest. His response, we were told, was that the government expected that, and they're actually surprised it hadn't happened already, because they've done what they can, haven't they, to decimate the economies around the world. And this includes today now, even lorry drivers' jobs are at risk because they've decided they're going to enroll prisoners to drive the lorries for minimum wage. It's a deliberate act. What part of it don't people see? Do you know?
I don't know, because I keep pointing these things out.
And it seems to me that a lot of people are kind of so horrified, they feel it can't be true, so it isn't true sort of thing, you know?
Yes, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on here, and I actually want to bring it back to a couple things. We're a little short on time, so I can't get into all the things with the shipping, and I believe that in the States, because we have Second Amendment rights, they cannot come at us quite the same way as other countries, so they're trying to starve us out.
Yes.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to bring up briefly about the immune systems being reduced to the equivalent of AIDS. It actually is AIDS. At a rate of 5% per week, which brings us to Christmas for a vast majority of the people in the United States. Brings them to Christmas to having zero immunity against anything. And then for the rest of them, depending on their age range, I had it all on a chart, but I don't have it in front of me, but I'll try to get that posted. But they also are going to go. So I think that the problem here with the government, the reason they're so being so draconian and being so nasty, and it will probably continue through the end of the year, is that they want to get us vaccinated. They want everyone to get it because everyone's going to catch on. It will be revealed because people are – you cannot hide this. You know, no matter what you do, after a certain point, it's not to be hidden, which brings me to when you were just had a little bit of a break right before this with a family. I wish you would. Could you tell us that story? Because it really.
Yes, and I can tell you they really won't mind me relaying that story. So they had a 28-year-old daughter who went into hospital for a minor procedure, and she was coerced while she was in there into having a shot and died in the bed a short while after from a blood clot. So we had a cremation funeral and they've just come in and collected their daughter's ashes. And as you can imagine, they're very, very upset, very angry. They know what's happened. They know what's happened. But obviously the health authorities and the government are not. They're dropping them like a shitty stick, to be honest with you, to be frank. They don't want to know them. They're very, very angry. And do you think any of those family are going to take that shot?
No. I mean,
They're going to fight to the death to avoid that, you know. And who can blame them? You know, we know what's happened. I know what's happened. And this is not one death. It's loads of deaths. I've looked after a 32-year-old, 33-year-old, a 42-year-old. They're all youngsters, you know, all sudden deaths or organ failure is the other one, as the immune system breaks down, you know, and the organs begin to fail. This is what's happening, you know. And it's quite sad because people kind of say to me, oh, you're so brave, you're so brave. What kind of guy would I be to know what I know and not say anything? Do you know? Why would I not say anything? You know, I'm a man that actually cares about people and I've got a moral compass. And here I see something terrible happening and nobody wants to address it. Nobody in government wants to address it. They want to force vaccinate, and they want to break the economy and destroy us all and have petrol shortages and water shortages and cut the electricity. And, you know, they're absolutely crackers. These people are insane.
They are. Well, I say to people all the time, if you're compliant, you are complicit. If you are not fighting this, then you're not on the right side. If you're not going against it, if you're not speaking out, you are on the wrong side, period, end of story.
I totally agree. But what you've got to remember is these people, a lot of them are victims. And we're not going to – there's no way on earth our governments are here to look after us. They're here to destroy us. I know that now. The only way we're going to survive is to re-engage with the masses who have been deceived and who will get sick and they will die. And only then will they realize, but they'll probably not be able to fight is the reality. And that's what the governments, certainly the British government, I feel are holding out for until the masses start dropping. What a great excuse to introduce martial law, you know,
well, you
and
know,
cherry-pick people from houses, you know?
Yes. Well, in the art of war, as you know, it is much more efficient to wound the enemy because it takes three people to take care of a wounded soldier versus to kill them. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. And they're weakening everything, weakening people. I mean, they started from the beginning, weakening immunity, keep you indoors, you know, suffocate you, put a diaper on your face.
Yeah, of course.
And,
only if you're coerced into wearing one. I refuse to wear one. I would never wear one because I know the truth. I've dressed 140 people they've labeled with a fake virus now, many of whom I suspect have been unlawfully killed. I've never worn a mask. My wife's helped me. She's never worn a mask. My embalmer's helped me. He's never worn a mask. It's a miracle we're alive. Surely, you know, and many of these people, because they've streamlined the system, I've been able to pick them up within 20 minutes of their death on occasion. You know, they're still very much warm and very much infectious if they were going to be infectious. They're not infectious.
Yeah, well, that gets back to a whole other thing of you know, what we've been lied to about science and, you know,
I mean, no doubt about what's happening. I don't think any of us are, you know. We're all singing off the same hymn sheet there. The what I fail to understand is why? Why would you want to kill everyone? Why? I mean,
well,
obviously, it's depopulation, but for what reason?
That's a whole other show, John.
is there a shortage of resources? Is the biosphere struggling? Is there a cataclysmic event about to happen? I don't understand why you would want to kill people's children.
Yeah, that's the whole thing where they don't see us as the same species. We are useless eaters to them. We are not the same. You know, we are children of a lesser god.
We're far better than ours.
No, that's what they say. That's what they say. That's not what I'm saying.
I agree, though, with them in that we're not the same as them. We're far better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have, you know, what this whole vaccine, and it gets much more nefarious as far as the separation of the, you know, on a spiritual level. Speaking of which, I want to shift because I know we have limited time, and I know that Kinthea wants to get to some really juicy questions that aren't so dire as the ones that we just talked about. So I'm going to pass the baton to her and take away, Kinthea.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, so John, I'm so deeply moved in hearing your firsthand account of what's going on there in the UK. And I'm also curious about the families. You keep mentioning the families, and I'm curious to know what kind of, you've touched on their responses. Do you see them taking action together? How do you see them
There's a mixture. So some families are blissfully unaware, you know, and the conversation will go much like, has mum or dad been vaccinated? And then they'll say yes, and they'll understand the angle of that question because they'll lead in with, oh, but it can't be that because it was 8 weeks ago. It can't be that because it was 12 weeks ago. They just don't make the connection, or they do make the connection, but can't believe that their government would do that to them. You know, so there are, I mean, it brings to mind the words, you know, ignorance is bliss. And if you're totally unaware and you think it is a natural death, how much nicer than realizing and coming to terms with the government have killed your loved one. So, and other people are well aware and they're very upset and they're very angry. Where do you go with that? Nowhere. There is nowhere to go. You can ask the coroner to take a look. He'll say, I've taken a look. It's a thrombosis. And they'll say, but it was just after you said, well, you know, it's a thrombosis. They won't. They're not allowed to dig any deeper than that. And these people are being threatened with their jobs. I know because I've had them reach out to me. You know, they're not only will they lose their job, but they'll be struck off their medical registers. And we're all slaves to the moneylender, aren't we? So these people are complicit through blackmail and coercion and intimidation. And that's what's happening. So, you know, I kind of, what disappoints me the most, I think, is the short-sightedness, because what do these people think is going to happen when they've finished with the last of us? And the last ones have been herded up into these death camps that have sprung up everywhere. Do they really think they're going to have a need for a coroner or a need for a local police officer or a need for a local MP, you know, or the need for a British Prime Minister when there is no one left? You know, they won't. They won't. And they will turn on them. They will turn on them and there'll be no one here to fight for them.
You don't see any watershed moment? Like, there must be some pent-up frustration that's going to explode. I mean, I can imagine you trying to contain it, but at some point, say they take one of your children, now they're aiming for your next one, I would fight to the death.
Yeah, I certainly will. Oh yeah, I certainly will. You know, I'm not gonna allow that. I'm not gonna allow that. And if that means I have to do a runner, I'll do a runner. And if that means I have to fight whoever comes to the death, that's what I'll do. That's what I'll do, because that's what I'll have to do, because we're under a deadly attack. You know, so you know, make no bones about it. You are under a deadly attack. You know, but I like to think that in a democracy, our human rights and our autonomy over our own bodies and something that our grandfathers collectively fought and died to form, the Nuremberg Code, would be respected. But it seems that these people are so complacent now, they openly ignore it. They're not interested. So, you know, what don't people understand about the gravity of that situation?
Well, I think also it's probably the education here, because the younger generation probably doesn't even know about the Nuremberg Code.
No,
and they probably have purposely not been taught about it.
Well, I think that's exactly the case. In fact, this is probably a discussion for a whole other show, isn't it? The education system.
Right.
Fundamentally broken from the bottom upwards. It's a twisted, sick beast that I would certainly love to pull my child out from on a permanent basis in a heartbeat, because it's broken beyond repair. And they're preaching sick doctrine, twisted ideologies, socialist values, and all other manner of really inappropriate stuff in British schools now that is just not acceptable, you know. There's a growing number of people that feel like that. But unfortunately, you know, the government, we're all slaves to the moneylender. People have to go to work, don't they? You know, so kids have to go to school. And unfortunately, it doesn't matter whether you vote for these murderous Tories or Keir Starmer. Now, Keir Starmer is the only opposition that's going to get in. He was the guy in charge of the Crown Prosecution Service at the time they chose not to prosecute Jimmy Savile, the notorious paedophile. You know, despite the mountain of evidence against him.
So you have no choices, really.
No, there is no choice. There is no choice until we get proportional representation. They talk about the Great Reset. I'd like to see them reset. I'd like to see them reset and them languishing in the prisons they've built for innocent people.
Right. So I'm curious. I at one time I worked as a florist. And so I also dealt with families that were facing the death of a loved one.
Yeah.
And there were times when I would notice that, you know, this is a moment of great reflection. It's a moment of, you take a pause and you review your life. You can't help review your life when a loved one goes.
Yeah,
and
course.
So I'm wondering, as you're witnessing these families, what are you noticing in that dimension? Is there some, I mean, is it going beyond just simply the frustration of it? Is there a higher octave of this, of another view of it?
Well, I think inevitably, a lot of people say to me, I could never do your job. And there's a number of reasons they say that. One is the kind of blood and guts side, if you like. Well, my father, when I was growing up, he was a butcher. So I was in and out of a butcher shop. And the inside of an animal is very much the same as the inside of a human. So the blood and guts side never really fazed me, you know, because I was exposed to it from an early age, seeing sides of beef and the inside of lambs and stuff. The other side of it, of course, is the grief and the emotional side. And I kind of put a positive spin on it where I actually go home and think, actually, I've had a really good day. That said, you kind of feel you're making a difference and it's something really worthwhile. When people come to see me and they're at their lowest ebb, you know, they've lost someone who's perhaps the most important figure in their life, or their closest loved one, their soulmate, whatever. It's really tough. It's really tough. But, you know, the added kind of the added grief to that now is dealing with them knowing that they're possibly been unlawfully killed. That kind of adds to the grief. You know, I can't get my head around that. And it's very painful. It's very painful for me as a funeral director, you know, dealing with that, especially when a family's kind of oblivious. When they're oblivious, it's kind of deception and murder. It makes it that much worse, at least to my mind, you know. And then you've got the families that are really angry with nowhere to go. And no, they're never going to get any justice. They're never going to see justice, are they?
No.
Unless we get it for them collectively.
I think here is where it becomes a question, an internal question.
Mm.
At some point, we have to look to our, you know, a sense of our eternalness. And I think that when we're pushed as far as we can in the material plane, that's when we break through to looking to other realms of understanding. Are you seeing any of that?
Probably on a personal level a little bit, I suppose. Religiously, it's very interesting how, I've never been a deeply religious man. I find myself praying daily now. And obviously, during the course of my work, I'm exposed to all different faiths, and I've got a great respect for them. And, you know, I kind of, you read scripture and you see bits and snippets, and a lot of what is going on is in scripture almost perfectly. And that can only really lead you down a spiritual path, I believe, you know. And I draw comfort from that, because death is a journey that we're all going to make. I'm not frightened of death. I'm frightened of continuing to live the way we are, with people being murdered all around us by people that we're supposed to be able to trust and are supposed to be looking after us, you know, doing that. This is no way to live. So I'm not frightened of death. I pray daily in the hope that there is a higher being and that he will come and save us from this terrible evil that's taking place. Because if he doesn't, I don't know who will. You know, will people rise up? I really don't know. I'd like to see it, and I'd like to follow that banner, you know, because I see what's happening firsthand, you know. And if I was on my own with this, and I was a conspiracy theorist and an anti-vaxxer, I could understand, you know, people having doubts, but I'm seeing this firsthand. I'm not in any doubt whatsoever. I've seen the evidence. I've spoke to the families. I've spoke to the doctors, the nurses, the scientists. I've had audience with Sir Graham Brady. They just don't give audience to conspiracy theorists, you know. I watched the body language on that man's face. He knew.
Right,
and my
speciality
is people, you know. And it's very interesting. While everyone was kind of giving their address, and the table was focused on whoever was speaking, I focused solely on Sir Graham because his body language and his reaction to the gravity of what was being said spoke volumes to me about him and how much he did or didn't know. And I genuinely believe that perhaps Sir Graham was there to gauge what we knew.
Exactly.
Which is really, really quite sad, because I always thought he was quite an honorable, decent human being, but perhaps I've read him wrong. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting how you phrase that. You're afraid of living this way, and touching on the scriptures. I have always thought I'd live in these end times, but they're also beginning times. And I think our species is on the brink of a huge change. And I do hold the vision that something is coming in, but I don't see it as outside us. I see that power is coming from within us, as like we're cells of a giant cosmic organism, and it's about to be revealed. So
I think you only have to look, I mean, for anyone with the least inquiring mind who's looked up at the plethora of stars that litter our skies and knows they're all suns. They're all suns that support other life, and they will have people up there perhaps looking at our star. And it would be lovely to feel part of that. But we've, of course, this is information we've collectively been denied, isn't it? So I think anyone who thinks we're alone is very narrow-minded and perhaps has been brainwashed, because a glance into the sky reveals all. Who those are, who those people are, and where they live and what they're all about, I'd love to know. I'd love to know, because I love meeting new people, you know. And, you know, we could be, I feel, so much more than we are. It's just sadly, I mean, imagine if they've made this much effort to cure cancer.
Well, maybe they've been making the effort to create cancer. Maybe creating.
I totally agree. But imagine if this amount of effort was made for good.
Right. Well, it will come to pass. It will come to pass. And by the way, we tend to think of ourselves as conspiracy analysts.
Yeah.
You know what? I want to bring Timothy in here. I'm sure he's chomping at the bit. Yeah, Timothy?
Well, thank you very much. The honor is mine. I first heard your voice on the Richie Allen radio show, and then I heard your in-depth interview with Max Egan, and
yes,
you really certainly came to the surface on my horizon, and you had literally millions of people hear your voice, and that voice is one of the very first voices we've ever heard. I say we've been researching and doing this show for what, a year and a half or something now, and you know, your voice is one of the very few that came from this direction where people, you have firsthand experience of people making the transition from life to death.
Yes.
So frankly, your conversation so far with Kintia and with Annetta, you've gone through, ripped through so many points of information, which I was going to ask you about, but I'm delighted because it means that we can move on to perhaps some different subject matters.
Different
perspectives, perhaps. One of the key points that we're also living in is this era of censorship. And
yes,
I'm very keen to ask you, following, you know, your interviews where you did gain so much prominence and so much attention because of your firsthand truth.
Yes.
How have you been treated by, firstly, your colleagues or your competition or the authorities?
Well, it's very, very interesting because my first kind of, I was obviously seeing what was going on firsthand on the coalface, and I was also seeing on social media the hysteria and the censorship from anyone who began to speak out. And I felt compelled. I just wasn't happy. I could see that what was being told to us was a total lie. And that feeling got stronger and stronger as the evidence piled up in front of me. And now I was on YouTube probably 8 months ago, 9 months ago. I had a YouTube account, and somebody made a comment about some COVID hysteria. And I kind of commented and said, look, I'll be honest, as an undertaker, that isn't what I'm seeing, you know. And within a couple of weeks, there was like 500 or 600 likes on that comment. And then my YouTube account was, without warning, just closed.
What a surprise.
Yeah. Well, it was a surprise to me because I didn't expect that, you know. I thought that kind of added fuel to my fire, because I thought then I'm definitely onto something here. So then obviously I've kind of posted a few books on Facebook, and again, I'm banned instantly. You know, Reuters, interestingly, discredited me, said that I didn't exist. I was on Twitter. I had a following of around 17,500, literally within a couple of weeks. And I publicly invited Reuters to speak to me, because I couldn't understand how they could discredit me and say that I didn't exist. When here I am, I'm not hard to reach. I've given everyone my details, my funeral home details. I've answered thousands of phone calls, thousands of emails, and I openly invite any politician to come and speak to me and have an open televised debate and reassure me that what they're doing is right. But nobody seems to want to do that. So I kind of, you know, I know what's going on, and it pains me. It just pains me.
It's insanity. It literally is the living embodiment of insanity.
Well, do you know, when I see a child, what do you see when you look at a child? I see a beautiful young soul that you should want to love and nurture like a young plant, you know, and teach things to and protect and nurture into a good person that contributes to society. And, you know, you have a responsibility as an adult to do that. So the thought of someone wanting to deliberately do them harm, I can't grasp that concept and what it is, you know, what a sick, twisted mind that must be. And certainly of no benefit to anyone whatsoever on this earth. And they should be eradicated from this earth. And I'm not on about doing anything like they're doing to us. I think in much the same way as a rabid dog, they should be literally just euthanized and cast out of society altogether, because they are destroying society. You know, why would you want to do this to a young child? I can't. And I think the trouble is, we go through life, don't we, and we think that everyone's like us, where you have a moral compass and you look at a child and think, what a beautiful thing that is, and how mm-hmm. we should nurture it and want to teach it and protect it, that child. But they don't. They just seem to want to hurt and maim and kill them. And that, it kind of goes against everything that I can mm-hmm. imagine, you know. Do they look at your child and think, let's kill it, whilst they look at their own child and think, there's the heir to my throne? Or what's the difference? I don't understand between Prime Minister's child and my child. What's the difference?
I don't think there's anything. There is no difference in the big picture, but the point is that, you know, there is this you know, separating groups of society. Mm. More than two, that there's the ones that are sort of, as I say, the puppet leaders.
Yes.
The weak-minded puppet leaders, they're driven by the puppet masters. And then we, the people, are sort of somehow segregated between those which are pro-follow the advice and just, you know, go and get jabbed, and those of us who are standing up and trying to bring more awareness and actually sharing the truth. So
I think the thing that concerns me the most is when you're in a position that I'm in, and you see what these jabs are doing, and you see the death and the misery and the sickness and illness, and what on earth do these people think would possess me to want to allow that in my body or in my child's body? My wife is terrified now because she sees firsthand what's happening, you know? Why would they think that we would want that in our bodies? And I think this is why you're going to see a mass exodus from the NHS, because they see firsthand, they're treating these vaccine injuries. They speak to the patients and they know what's going on. So many of these people simply will never, ever allow that into their bodies willingly.
Indeed. John, going back to my question, I don't wish to go in circles.
Yeah, cool.
Are there competitors out there in your city, in your area, which are towing the line and actually going along with this?
So some of them will be totally invested in COVID, and I suspect those will be the ones who have been double jabbed, for example. You have to remember, when this first happened and we were all told about it, everyone was very frightened. You know, they were going to the hospitals with coffins and sealed body bags. People were going straight in, the coffins were being sealed there, or the body bags were being taken back to base and the body bags were being placed in a coffin, you know. Yes. And there was a number of reasons for that. Some of them would have been because they were invested in COVID and believed it and were very frightened. For others, it became very easy to do that because there's a minimum of effort required. So yes, that lends itself to people who perhaps don't really want to make the effort and perhaps don't really care. Interestingly, though, I'm being reached out to almost daily now by other undertakers who are all saying, thank you so much. It's so important what you're talking about. And you know, we support you fully. But they're all terrified, because anyone that's going to commit mass murder of genocide on a global scale won't think twice about bumping off a mouthy undertaker, will they? And I know that, you know, I fully accept that. But if my legacy could be saving one life somewhere, then I don't care. Kill me. You know, I really don't care. Because living like this is just, it's horrible anyway, isn't it?
You know, very brave and honorable sentiments.
Well, I don't feel that it is brave. I think it would be far harder not to say anything because I have a moral compass that drives me to do that.
I agree with you. But what I'm saying is that, you know, one thing is talking hypotheticals and principles, but another thing is that people do need to pay their mortgage or they need to pay their rental car or their credit card, whatever it is. And those people are the ones that I feel very sorry for because they really are being coerced and manipulated to higher levels than perhaps people who are more independent.
I would sooner live in a tent in the woods, though, than I would allow them to poison me. Well, because you'd have no life at all, would you? You know, you get sick and you'll die. That's the reality. So for me as a business, I've found that it's actually benefited my business because people see the integrity and the honesty in me and they're flocking to me. I've had to turn work away, you know, because I don't have the capacity to look after everyone.
John, I was going to say, one of the things that this leads perfectly on, one of the things that came across from listening to your early interviews and also when we've talked since then is the care and attention you do give to the people who have lost their lives. And one of the things that I'm very curious about, and I don't mean to be morbid in any way at all, but you know, death is coming to everybody. The physical body will at a certain point not continue in its physical form. We can speculate hugely about what happens after that point, about the soul or the spirit or whatever it is. I'd love to talk about that. I think it's going to have to be in another show. But right now, I'm very curious to know, for example, I lost my father some years ago. Mm. And what happens, what normally happens between the moment somebody is signed off as deceased and what happens between that moment and the moment in which case they are either cremated or put to rest or buried. May I ask you just the very basic stepping stones of what you go through? Because I think most people don't know this.
Yeah, so I would get a phone call to go and collect someone from their place of death if it was outside office hours. Obviously, it would be outside the hospital environment. I would go and collect that person. They'd be placed on my stretcher and placed in my ambulance and brought back to the funeral home. I would comb their hair. I would put cream on their face because their skin dries out otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I would measure them for a coffin and I would take a handprint. And the idea of taking that handprint is to be able to put that on a piece of paper and put a photograph next to it and laminate it so that they can hold their mum or dad's hand and look at that photo. And it's just something. Yeah, it's just something that I find people, it gives them comfort. So I do it. And I do it for everyone, you know. So then I would arrange to meet the family the following day, perhaps, or later in the week, depending on when the call came in. And I would sit and arrange the funeral with them and book that online. Most of them are cremations and then would tailor the funeral for them. So if mum or dad liked certain things, then, you know, those certain things, we would try and implement them into the funeral. I hasten to add, you know, I'm not one for selling add-ons. My feeling is, for example, with limousines, they're an expensive taxi, you know, and I tell people that, so, you know, whilst I can get them for you if you want them and you want to be able to focus on grieving, okay, that's fine. But my advice is if you can bring yourself to drive, drive, because it saves your money. And money's for the living, isn't it? You know, it's, and if you spoke to anyone's parents, and I can tell you, my dad, he always say to me, put me in the green bin, you know, and there'd be plenty of people that laugh just like you did then, because all our parents would all say the same. And everyone that comes in is no exception. They're there because they love their mum or dad and their mum and dad love them. And that's why they feel like that. So I don't encourage people to spend a penny extra than they have to spend. And then simple little things, like I'll ask them what kind of things their mum and dad likes. And if she loves knitting, I'll put some knitting balls and knitting needles on the coffin plate or something like that. You know, it's just little bits to make it personal.
Do you also dress dress the bodies?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, all of them. Yeah, wash and dress all of them, whether they're, even if there's no viewing, because it's important, especially when you feel that sometimes in hospitals, you know, people have lost their loved one over a Zoom call or standing there in a hazmat suit and they haven't been cared for. It's important that you do care for them. I want them to feel cared for, the care that they didn't have in life.
So one of the things that strikes me very, very clearly is you're offering a great deal of, you know, care, compassion, and you're sending people on their way in dressed in a way that they, you know, with respect.
Yes.
And what I'm seeing, what I'm learning from, let's just say, people who are COVID believers, pandemic believers, shall I say, they're zipping them up in a bag and stuffing them in a box, and that's the end.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't bring myself to do that. And early on in the process, I was washing and dressing people, wondering when I would get it and die. Mm. But I don't, you know, I don't care. My urge to take care of people is too strong. And I was waking up every morning and taking a deep breath and wondering, you know, would I be all right that day? And I was, and another day and another day passed. And it wasn't too long before I realized, you know, that this isn't true. The whole thing isn't
absolutely
true.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that a phenomenon I've noticed among people who have vaxxed is that they go through a stage where they actually feel like they're superheroes, you know, Superman or Superwoman or something. They can go anywhere.
Yeah.
They can travel. They can do anything. They're free. And that is such a delusion.
I feel really, really sorry for them. I can't... I struggle to say anything negative about them because I'm desperate to re-engage with them so we can save each other.
Of course.
It's a great strategy, divide and conquer, isn't it? Whether it be the vaccine or Black Lives Matter, or, you know, they've made great efforts, haven't they, to alienate everyone. And, you know, some of my very best friends are African and Indian and Hindu people, and, you know, Hindus in particular. What beautiful people they are. Yeah, they're all telling us Black Lives Matter, and you know, they're promoting all this homophobia, and they're things that just don't really exist, you know. And it's all designed to split us up and divide us, and it's worked, hasn't it?
Black Lives Matter to me, BLM to me means blatant lies and manipulation.
Of course it is. And any person of colour that I know who I've spoken to have totally agreed it's absolute rubbish. But the reality is, for example, you can get 1.5 million people walk through London protesting about these Nazi passports, and it's not news, is it? It's not even mentioned, yet you get 2 dozen climate change idiots block the M25 and it's mainstream news. And people suck it up. They suck it up. They believe it. You know, they work in insurance and they work as estate agents. So they come home, they kick their slippers off, and they log on to Facebook, and they watch Netflix with a warm latte in front of their big flat screen telly. And that's about as involved in it, you know, as they get. They don't see. You only see what they want you to see, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, we're all victims of programming and on different levels, some much higher degrees than others.
Yes.
But I mean, if we look at something like a movie, I mean, when I was, a teenager, I enjoyed the movie Amadeus. It was Amadeus Mozart, of course.
Yes.
And it was a very, very dramatic scene. I always remember the amazing, piece of music, the sequence where his wife is racing back to see him, and he's on his deathbed, and his, you know, father, he thinks his father is dressed up in this, big black suit with a hood and the mask, strangely enough. And eventually, the wife doesn't quite make it in time, and it's all done to the beat of the music, and the horse is galloping and so on through the night. But eventually, the end of the movie is, sorry if there's any spoilers out there, but Mozart is put into a common grave amongst, you know, hundreds of other people. Apparently, he died of some sort of plague or some sort of, viral end came to him. And it was just a mass of bodies, which was covered with, like, people shoveling in powdered lime, I think it is, to make, I don't know what it is to do, to sort of sanitize,
so,
I guess.
Yeah, try and sanitize, yeah. Trying to get that.
But, I mean, that's the picture that we've sort of seen through Hollywood and through television. I'm not trying to say this is the reality, but, why is that not happening now if this pandemic is real? I mean, this is so far.
I think you've kind of answered your own question, because the pandemic isn't real. Exactly. What we are going to see very shortly is a huge death rate exclusively in vaccine recipients.
Indeed. Indeed. I'm sorry to hear that, but at the same time, I don't think we're at the end of the tunnel yet. No.
No, I don't as well. And I've got the greatest faith in good being a stronger force in love than being a stronger force in hate. So I kind of hope that if you think about it logically, the people that are responsible for this, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
If you had a room full of these devils that are arranging this, how many people do you think are around them who love them? None. There won't be a single one. They'll be all very frightened of them. So therefore, these people have no concept of love. They
no.
don't understand it. They won't have any comprehension of it or what people will do for that love. You know, a mother will throw herself into a burning house for the love of her child. We all know that. These people don't understand that concept. And I think that will fundamentally be their undoing. They don't understand what people would do for love. And when people realize what these demons have done to us, even their own armies will turn on them, I'm convinced, because they'll understand what these people have done. I'd like to think we would get a helping hand from the Lord or the higher being, whoever it is, you know, but I'm convinced that we will win through. But as with any wars, there are always casualties, aren't there? You know, and this will be no exception, sadly. I think this is a war, every bit World War III, and it's on a biblical scale.
Mm-hmm. I think, well, at one point, I think that because the vaccines are an experiment, I think by nature of every experiment, there must be inert or neutral injections being given as well as
Of course. I mean, the feeling is certainly the feeling is among the scientific community and the people that I've spoken to that they're using something called the advocate system. So the way that works is if you have, for example, and they're very good at hiding the truth right in front of you, aren't they? So if,
indeed,
for example, they say these vaccines are 85% effective, they're 85% safe. The 15% is designed to maim and kill. That's your COVID. But what you've done then is you've recruited 85% of the people who have taken a placebo, who are then advocates. They've been recruited as advocates, haven't they? Because they haven't caught COVID. The vaccines are totally safe. They certainly haven't got ill because they've had a placebo. And therefore, they're going to then advocate that. And I kind of wondered for a while. I thought, well, how are they going to target the people that have had a placebo? And then they announce regular boosters 3 a year for 5 years. So what you've got in effective is you turn up for a shot and it's a Russian roulette and you're either lucky or you're not. And the question I would pose to people is, do you think you can be lucky 3 times a year for 5 years? The answer is no, is the reality. But it's a very clever, it's insane genius, really, because you're advocating 85% of the people you're using them to recruit, you know, to kill, kind of thing. It's amazing genius.
John, is there anything you'd like to bring our attention to, anything for our listeners to follow or to look at? Is there a website or some information where we can find what you're up to?
To be honest with you, there is no real update for me personally. All I would say is the same as I've said all along. These injections are very, very dangerous. They're in the experimental stage. They're maiming and killing people. COVID isn't a real fear to be wary of. Take your masks off. What we need is massive non-compliance. And just don't listen to these people, because what they're telling you is not the truth. And this is not just from an undertaker who tells you his experience on the coalface, but for a number of extremely well-qualified scientists and professors who are not on the government or big pharma payroll, you know. So my advice is, you know, I will never, ever, ever willingly be part of an experiment. I would never, ever accept my human rights and the Geneva Code being violated, and willingly accept these gene therapies. You know, Dr. Maddie.
Yes, Kerry Maddie.
Yeah, you only have to look at what's actually in these. It's horrific. It's horrifying. And I'd love to give my vaccine to Boris Johnson personally and put it in him and see how he feels about having it, you know. And I can tell you, he won't take it. He won't take it. He'll sit there and have a placebo or be one of the dozens of faked videos where they pretend to put it in. Mm-hmm. They're not even decent enough to make a good job of that, are they? You know, it's, awful people. So my advice is just non-compliance, guys. Totally don't comply. And I know that's hard when you've got bills to pay, and I totally get that, and it's easy for an undertaker to say that. But trust me, we're all going to be shut down soon. It's only going to be a matter of time. You know, they're bringing in these Nazi-type passports. I'll never engage with those. I'm never going to comply. So you know, my days are probably numbered as well. You know, we're all in this together, aren't we, you know?
Let's keep going with the truth, and I admire what you're doing, and I appreciate you coming on the air and telling us all about
the truth.
It.
Yeah, it's just the truth. You know, this has been my experience as a funeral director, and what kind of guy would I be if I wasn't honest and didn't tell people? I'd be an awful guy, you know, and I refuse to be complicit in Saint Sohenius.
Despite the initial unpleasant realization of the truth, you will see there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is an increasing number of respected journalists, writers, politicians, doctors, lawyers, influencers, artists, activists, and innovators who are wide awake and are already making great impact. All they require from you is to unplug from mainstream and social media propaganda, to make your own independent research, to stop acquiescing, and to stand up for what you believe in with respect to others. Remember, you were born with power and you wake up each day with power. It is entirely up to you how you choose to retain or give it away. You've been listening to another live broadcast of The Other Side of the News. The 77th edition is entitled Exhuming the Truth and remains available to all listeners free of charge at www.theothersideofthenews.com. My name is Timothy Saunders, and together with Cynthia and Annetta, offer special thanks to our guest, John O'Looney. We wish you all a very positive week and look forward to reconnecting with you all on our next edition, next Friday. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, my God.